All right, it is time to begin this evening. It is 7 o'clock exactly, according to my laptop clock, my phone clock, and my watch, so that means we're right on the button. If you remember it all from Sunday, or if you weren't here and you've just forgotten, we're in Mark chapter 7 at the moment. The overall class is trying to understand why Jesus says the things he does and how we can, and actually what his actions indicate as well. He seems to always be teaching, not only with the words that he speaks to people, but the actions that he takes as well. And so for us, we're trying to understand better maybe some ways that we can implement these things into our own lives when we're trying to reach out to other members of the church, people out in the secular world that we interact with, that we see, we find teaching opportunities and various moments that we can take advantage of to spread the gospel message, to spread the good news about Jesus. And if we can adopt the things that Jesus did very well, extremely well, then we're going to be more effective in that endeavor. We're going to kick it off by looking at Mark chapter 7, verses 24 through 29. I will have the text up on the screen for you this evening, but I'd like to invite you to open up your Bibles as well and turn to that passage. We'll get that started here in just a moment. Just a reminder quickly of what we covered on Sunday. We dealt mostly with verses 14 through 23, I believe, which probably should have been paired together, or definitely certainly need to be paired together, I would say, with the first 14 verses that David, or 13 verses, however many it was, 13 verses that David covered the previous Sunday. So we had two Sundays worth of kind of the same thing, but Jesus dealing with three individual groups, the scribes and the Pharisees, and then also his disciples on the side, and him calling the people together again. And you see how he deals with each of those groups individually and how he deals with them in different ways. And so talking about overlooking the most important things about the law that had been given to them by Moses and by God, and instead choosing to focus on things that they had implemented themselves, traditions rather than commandments, and the hypocrisy in that. And then Jesus explaining more fully to his disciples themselves when they asked, and him showing a little bit of his concern that they did not truly understand the things that he had been teaching. And they've been with him for a while now, and they're still having an issue understanding these things. All right, so the first episode, I suppose, or story that we're going to be dealing with this evening is that of the Syrophoenician woman that Jesus comes into contact with. So after Jesus deals with the Pharisees and the scribes and then this group of people, whoever that may be, and then his disciples on at a more intimate level, he picks up and he takes off to the region of Tyre and Sidon. So he goes from, well, actually, let me just read this bit of text, and then we'll talk a bit about that a little bit more. So I want to go ahead and just read the first three verses here, verses 24 through 26 with you, and then we'll discuss Jesus travels a bit and what brings him to this region. Starting in verse 24, "And from there he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon, and he entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. But immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter." Okay, so this woman that he encounters is a Syrophoenician, and that all that means is that he was within the region of Phoenicia, which is inside the province of Syria. So she was a woman that lived in this region, in this province of Syria. Jesus, as close as I can tell, he had not left the Capernaum and Gennesaret area of next to the Sea of Galilee, so it would be the northwest corner of the Sea of Galilee. As he's dealing with the Pharisees and the scribes and then his disciples, he would still be in that on that northwest portion of the Sea of Galilee. But we have him traveling north here up through Galilee and into Gentile territory, into Tyre, and then so he stays within the Tyre region for this first episode with this woman, and then he moves on to Sidon, it'll tell us later, which is even further north. Tyre and Sidon being highlighted in pink there, and then at the end of the chapter it finds him moving back south into the area of Decapolis, which is that orange area, hopefully you can see it okay, that is attached to, or at least protruding off of the southeast corner of the Sea of Galilee. So he journeys north into Gentile territory, and then he sweeps down back around into Decapolis. Which, is, on a side note, Decapolis means ten cities in Greek. I don't know if there's actually just 10 cities within it, but that would stand to reason if there were. Anyway, back to our text then. So the Syrophoenician woman who lives in the region of Phoenicia, the province of Syria, is a Gentile woman. Now there is a parallel passage to this story that's found in Matthew chapter 15, verses 21 through 28. Matthew provides a few details that Mark doesn't actually give us. It tells in Matthew that she's of Canaanite descent, that she's a descendant of the Canaanite people, which if you remember, recall in the Old Testament, this is a people that God ordered the Israelites to destroy, to wipe out. But apparently she still exists as a part of that. And then in verse 23 of Matthew chapter 15, when she first comes to him, it says Jesus ignores her. He does not answer her a word. And then his disciples come up to him and say, send her away, for she is crying out after us. So the disciples have become annoyed with her persistence. It seems like she was following them constantly trying to get Jesus' attention, the disciples, to the point where the disciples came and begged him, please send this woman away from us. So there's a little bit of background information, a bit of information that Matthew provides. But she comes on behalf of her little daughter who has an unclean spirit, and it says that she falls down at Jesus' feet in verse 25. And so Jesus' reaction at first is to ignore her, as we find in the Matthew account. But she's begging him. She says, please, Lord, on behalf of my daughter, cast out this demon. This woman is demonstrating a good amount of faith here in her persistence and in her kneeling at Jesus' feet, her begging him to cast this demon out. But The story does continue on. Another note about Tyre and Sidon is that you might think to yourself that this woman, you know, would not have heard of Jesus. He goes to this place. He doesn't want to be known. He's trying to hide, and he's in this house. But this woman still is able to find him. Well, earlier in Mark chapter 3, verses 7 through 8, it reads, Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the sea, and a great crowd followed from Galilee and Judea and Jerusalem and Idumea and from beyond the Jordan and from around Tyre and Sidon. So we know from earlier on in Mark's account, that Tyre and Sidon, at least some of the people from there, had already been following Jesus and would have been aware of what he was, what he was able to do. They would have at least seen some sort of miracle from him. So word certainly probably would have spread throughout the region of Tyre and Sidon, at least those two cities, about who Jesus was. And so she was able to find out that he was in the area and knew immediately to come to him. And in Matthew, in chapter 11, verse 21, Jesus is speaking and he says, woe to Chorazin, woe to Bethsaida, for if the mighty works were done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. I think I left out a word there. But so this gives us an indication that Jesus knew that there were good people in Tyre and Sidon, that there were people worth ministering to. That if they had had the opportunity to see the things that other people had seen, that other cities had been given access to, that they would have reacted in quite a different way. And so, with those things in mind, we can move on to the rest of the story and the last four verses here. Picking up in Mark 7, verse 27, "And he said to her, 'Let children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs.' But she answered him, 'Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs.' And he said to her, 'For this statement you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter.' And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone." Yes. Yes, Al.
Before you jump too far, I just want to make one point.
Yes, sir.
She addresses him as son of David. That's significant. I think she knows who he is. So she didn't know. So she has to be at least one of the people. But she knows who he is and knows that he is Christ.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't pick up on that. I missed it apparently, but it's possible that she was one of those people. She was included in the group in Mark chapter 3 that had been with Jesus from that region. It's possible that she had seen firsthand. But yes, to your point then, she absolutely knew exactly who he was for her to call him son of David. I guess my first question for you this evening is, what's something that jumps out to you about this passage? It can be about the woman. It can be about the way Jesus approaches her or deals with this encounter. Or it can be about the disciples trying to turn her away or asking him to send her on her way. Go ahead, Al. Yeah, sure.
Right off the bat, I think it's obvious that it has to do with the Gentile. And that's important.
Yeah.
His disciples, of course, I guess, don't want him to do that. Or they're trying to keep him from doing it. It doesn't say why he was reluctant. Maybe he knew that it was in their hearts. I don't know. We can't determine that.
Sure. Yeah, there's some things we can only speculate on, right? But absolutely, the fact that she's a woman, the fact that she's of Canaanite descent, as Matthew tells us, the fact that she is a Gentile from an area, she's not just a Samaritan, she's not a Samaritan that would have been half Jew, half Gentile, or a mixed combination of the, she's a straight up Gentile, you know, and for Jesus to travel that far north out of the realm of the chosen people, I think probably would have been certainly saying something to his disciples. Go ahead, yeah, Jeff.
Yeah, I know we're primarily focused on Jesus
and right.
How he's teaching, but the woman definitely jumps out here in the story. She appears to be pretty remarkable. You mentioned she's a Gentile. She's a female Gentile.
Right.
And so I think it demonstrates a tremendous amount of faith, but also fearlessness and dogged perseverance to engage Jesus the way she did, especially if Al's right and she knew who he was or had some idea who he was. For her to do what she did in that fearless way. But I think she also showed a genuine humility in response to her and a submissive quality. As well, I don't know how much we're going to spend like breaking down the metaphorical components of this parable and talk about the children and the dogs and whatnot, but it seems like it's probably relates to the relationship between the Jews and the Gentiles.
Yeah, I agree, certainly. She demonstrates, as you mentioned, a couple of different qualities here that. And she would not have been a respectable person. She would not have had the respect of Jesus' disciples at all. And yet she's able to demonstrate things that they're not demonstrating. And I think there's... Okay, I think I saw your hand first, sir. In the purple there. Yes, sir. So, I don't know your name. I apologize.
He says, but he answered and said, I am not sent into the lost sheep, but to the house of Israel. So here's the... You say, not recognizing her as a Gentile... It's like he's saying back there, his primary mission is to go to the Jews first.
Yeah.
So it's almost like putting her aside for a moment.
Yeah, and it's, in my opinion, it's got to be a test for her, or it's got to be some sort of test for his disciples, because here he is traveling through this region, you assume purposefully, you assume he's choosing to go this route for a reason, and yet he says, well, I'm here to bring this message to the Israelite people, the Jewish people who are chosen. I'm not here to bring it to you. And so that strikes me as something that's got to be a test of some sort. Jeff, you had your hand?
Yeah, both Matthew and Mark record this incident after Jesus talked to the Pharisees about what defiles a person.
Yeah.
And so he goes into Gentile country, and this Gentile woman comes up, and his disciples, it's pretty clear from Matthew's account, are thinking, Jesus, we need to get rid of her. It's inappropriate. She shouldn't even be expecting a healing.
Yeah.
And I think the way Jesus challenged her and got her to express her faith may have been more for his disciples' benefit than anyone else, to make the point to them that just because she's a Gentile doesn't mean she's defiled. This is a woman who has faith, and this is a woman who can be healed, and her child can be healed because of the faith that she has.
Yeah, I agree with that. Absolutely. Dave?
I mean, the ultimate truth is Jesus didn't just come for the
right.
Jew.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't. And I think Jeff's spot on. I think he is, I think he's making a point here. And I think he's saying what he expects people to say and kind of putting it out there to set this up. But I think his point is to send a really important message about everyone and about all of humanity, and about faith is what ultimately matters, not your situation or your status. And he could have just made that point and said it, but this whole little code thing with, you know, let me throw this allegory at you, almost feel, or allegory, what, metaphor at you, almost feels like, come back at me with this. Like,
yeah.
And she does, I think. She gets it, or plays right into what he wanted her to
yeah.
do, and gave the perfect answer to his little riddle or whatever that he's putting out there. And I think it's kind of a beautiful interchange between the two of them, and he points that out as that's a demonstration of faith, and then he seals it by the miracle of healing her child.
Yeah, I agree with you, definitely. I think he just kind of sets it out there for her to take, and knowing she's going to take a hold of that. She's going to take that and run with it and let his disciples see that message or hear that message from her. It's pretty, well, it's Jesus we're talking about, so of course it's pretty brilliant. Go ahead, Al.
I'm not sure you want to get into it, but let the children be fed first. He talks about later on, too, because he talks about the children being innocent. They will go to heaven without much effort. And I think this is tracking with everything he says and does. He's consistent.
Yeah, well, he takes the... I think, if I remember correct, in Mark 9, I think, is where he takes the child and sets the child in front of his disciples and says, this is the person who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. This is the person you want to imitate and pattern your life after, this small, innocent child. I thought I saw another hand over here, but maybe not. I'm sorry. Okay, Roy and then Terry.
The lesson I get out of that, you know, Jesus went to basically a foreign country,
yeah.
you know, and entered a house and says he didn't want to be found.
Yeah.
So, you know, he was out of his comfort zone. And this woman comes in and she finds him and you know, and redirects that, you know, she's not really, you know, what he's directed to at that particular time. But he got out of his comfort zone, took care of her. You know, I think the lesson for us is, you know, that when we look at somebody as a convert for the Lord, you know, we probably need to get out of our comfort zone. You know, this lady was not a good candidate for Jesus, you know. But when she was there and she knew what he could do, how he could help her, you know, I think the big lesson for us is that we pick and choose, you know, who we pick.
Yeah, and to be fair, she did show some persistence, right? She did, especially in Matthew's account, it seems to accent that more, or the idea of her just kind of following behind Jesus, begging him over and over, and the disciples being like, okay, we're getting tired of this. You know, she's no one to us. She's not important. And obviously these are just my opinions, but the way I read the passage and understand in the beginning, and when he first comes to Tyre and Sidon, it says he's you know, kind of quietly entering this house, and he doesn't want people to know he's there necessarily. His purpose should not be to minister to these people, because he says, you know, the children need to be fed first. It's not time for the Gentile people to receive the message quite yet. I think he's saying, you know, this message is for the lost sheep of Israel first. And so he's not trying to be as public with the ministry in this region. I get the sense personally that he's kind of taking his disciples on a tour of outside of Israel and saying, hey, you guys are going to be accountable for these people someday. You're going to be the ones that take the message to the entire world, you know, not just the region of Judea and Samaria. You're going to take it to the remotest parts of the earth, and you're going to make sure it gets spread around. And these are some of the people you're going to be dealing with. And you need to get comfortable with that, I think, is kind of what he's doing here. That's the impression that I get. Maybe you might disagree with me on that, but that's the way I'm reading it. Terry, you had a thought?
Yeah, you know, all the things that have been said, and really, I agree with, it brings out what the Lord is doing here. In addition, I see what jumps out to me is this lesson on the character of God. The master teacher is at work here. I think this is one of the few places in the Bible where, as I can recall, where the Lord or God changed his mind. In the old, when Moses pleaded to God not to destroy all of the people for their murmuring and rebellion, you know, Moses reasoned with God, said, no, if you do this, then it's going to give opportunity for all of the nations to say, see, their God just brought them out there to slay them in the wilderness. And so Moses reasoned with God, so God relented. And here, the Lord Jesus Christ, he changed his mind that he can have mercy on who he will have mercy. And he had mercy on this woman, and he changed his mind. So, okay. And I can't recall in his interactions with people, the Pharisees, or the New Testament, or in the Gospels, that he changed his mind like this. So to me, it teaches persistence. When, to apply it to my own life, personally, I studied this, I thought of Moses, it changed how I prayed to God. If I thought the answer was no because of this, I didn't stop asking. It's ask, seek, and knock. He wants us to go to him. I don't know if you get angry at me if I keep asking.
Sure. Yeah. I'm trying to think of, in my own mind, I guess, I'm trying to think about how, like, what the Gentile, the idea that she's a woman, she's a Gentile, she's unworthy, what's the application there for us in our lives, you know? Obviously, we're not Jesus, but we're disciples of his, and we want to spread the message to the world, and there are probably some people that I would look at in my own life and look unfavorably upon them, I suppose, or, you know, think, well, they're not going to be receptive to the message and just be pretty dismissive about them quickly. But, you know, if someone shows interest, if someone shows persistence, then I need to acknowledge that and be aware of it and be willing to teach them, even if they're somewhat unsavory towards me or I get a bad, you know, they leave a bad taste in my mouth, something along those lines. I'm trying to think of exactly who that may be, but, you know, hopefully there's no one that we're not willing to go to. Hopefully there's not anyone that we encounter in our own lives that we're not willing to speak to about Jesus. Al and then Jeff.
Remember what he said about the wedding guest, about being up, who's going to go up in front, and whether or not it's the beggar or whether it's the one behind clothes. And I think, again, he's being consistent, and he's doing it here, too. And I think for us, the message is
don't assume, because of some way somebody's grasped it, but even what they profess to be, that they're lost forever. We need to try. We need to open our mouths. We need to try.
Yeah. So this kind of reminds me, it takes me back to what Jesus was saying in 14 through 23 about it's not what someone takes into them, it's not what they import into themselves that defiles them, it's what they export, or it's the things that they expel. And he goes through this list of things. At the same time, he's saying this woman is expelling positive things, good things. She's showing faith and great humility, and she's expelling virtuous things and recognize that. She's, you know, maybe she's she doesn't have the right appearance on the outside, but what's inside is the opposite of the scribes and Pharisees, where they have a bad heart and they're expelling evil things or hypocritical thoughts and desires. She's expelling virtuous things. And I think probably that she's certainly at the very least an object lesson for the disciples, and more than that, but at least that in this case, I believe. Jeff.
Yeah, you know, I think one thing that I learned from this is the disciples didn't expect the Lord to help this woman. I think Matthew makes that pretty clear. And just because we may find ourselves in a congregation someday or in some environment where there's a bias or prejudice against some people, we can't let that ever stop us from teaching someone else the gospel. Just because there's someone else who has some bias and it's, you know, or prejudice or anything like that, we can never let that deter us from trying to reach people with the gospel.
Yeah, I'm racking my brain trying to figure out what that might look like, or what sort of biases we would be subject to. At one point in this country, it was probably racism, right? There was probably a racist bias that had to be dealt with. And then maybe more along today's lines, there's a homosexual bias that we probably have to face and deal with, and you know, where they're different issues. Obviously, race and sexuality are not similar at all, really. But homosexuals are sinners just like us. They deserve to hear the message just like we do, just like we took advantage of it. And so we shouldn't show bias towards that group of people, or the LGBTQ+, whatever it's gotten to now, that community. Just because, you know, we think that they live a certain lifestyle, an unsavory lifestyle, or something like that. That's the only application in my own mind I'm making at the moment. Go ahead, Scott.
I'll tell you something that I think we need to be cautious about.
Okay.
And it is the division between raised in the church and raised somewhere else, which I think is not that dissimilar from the feelings about raised in the law of Moses versus raised somewhere else. I think there's often kind of a tendency that, you know, we all understand this, and those people don't. And you know, across that divide, some of us as bigger. But I think there is some of that going on. We can kind of take pride in our spiritual ancestry and maybe forget that there's a lot of souls out there that would like some of the crumbs from the table.
Sure. That's something that I'm not familiar with myself, being on the right side of that line, you know, being raised on the pew. But that's something you've experienced personally, I suppose, and so that sounds definitely like it's very prevalent to me. Yes, sir, go ahead.
Yeah, I think what we have to get to is remember that Jesus says, he said to the lost sheep, you know, of Israel,
yeah,
the gospel first was for the Jews, not to the Gentiles, until Acts 10, you know, Peter,
yeah,
when he first started. And it, keep in mind, this is Jesus doing preaching now, and he doesn't say go preach to all nations until he's ready to go back to heaven. All authority, go preach to all nations. And even at Jerusalem, it didn't start until they were scattered, and the message to the Gentiles, even though Gentiles were profiting some, you know, like the Samaritan woman at the well, you know, he got some believers out of that.
Yeah.
I think that this woman here, he says, when he talks about the children, he's saying, if you're Jewish, before you feed the dogs, because the Samaritans and others were considered dogs at this time.
Yeah. And I think of the case of the Roman centurion as well, the great faith that he demonstrated towards Jesus. So we see Jesus willing to interact and deal with these people, these outsiders, so to speak, and even help them and perform miracles for them of healing or casting out demons, whatever. But the bulk of his work is done within the confines of the Jewish nation. Because, as to your point, it wasn't their time. It wasn't time for the Gentiles to receive the message yet. But we still see him willing to interact and work with these people as well. Is another thought before we? Yes, Brent.
I think one here that's apparent also is that she recognizes that his message was primarily to Jews, because she makes the statement that, you know, even the dogs get the crumbs from the children.
Yeah.
And she recognizes her position. And she says, I'm just asking for mercy. I know where I sit in the pecking order here, but I'm asking you to make an exception and to help me.
Yeah, she's pretty quick on her feet, it seems like, because she keeps with the metaphor that he lays out. And she gives such a positive, strong response. But to your point, she shows that she understands where place is. Maybe if she had responded differently and said something to the effect of, I'm one of those dogs too, or I'm the top dog, you know, because I'm being persistent, I'm demonstrating great faith towards you right now. But she was humble about it and respectful and kept in line with the metaphor. Go ahead, Brent. Yeah.
She could have gone and ridiculed Jesus, says, you know, you're giving preferential treatment to the Jews and all the healing you're doing, and you're completely ignoring the common folks. And Jesus went out of his way to seek her out, because the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. And so we have to always remember that. And of course, we know that says in Romans chapter 1 as well, that he came to Jews first and also to Gentiles. So
yeah.
It's just important to us to know that it's part of God's plan, and she's actually recognizing what's going on, and she's just asking for his help and all faith and understanding that he is who he says he is.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. Another thought before we move on to our next passage. All right. So let's go ahead and look at Mark chapter 7, verses 31 through 37, which is the end of the chapter. Again, there's a parallel passage in Matthew chapter 15, except it's shorter and it's pretty vague. I think it mentions a deaf man in Matthew, but that's about all it does. It mentions other healings as well, but a very vague general passage, whereas Mark chooses to focus on this one particular man here in this passage. So we'll go ahead and read 31 through 37. Then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee and in the region of the Decapolis. And they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment. And they begged him to lay his hand on him. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers into his ears, and after spitting, touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, Ephphatha. It's a difficult word there. That is, be opened. And his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. And Jesus charged them to tell no one. But the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, he has done all things well. He even makes the deaf to hear and the mute speak. So, so Jesus, back to our map quickly. Jesus went up from Tyre through Sidon and then came back down into Decapolis on the southeastern shore of the Sea of Galilee. And so I'll go ahead and say the one thing that stands out to me here is that, or the main thing that stands out to me here, is that he takes this man aside privately. And then he puts his fingers into his ears and he spits on his tongue. And then he speaks the word that I'm not going to try and pronounce again, and which means be opened. But he does this away from the crowd. And it even says that he sighs and looks up towards heaven as he's doing it. But is there significance there? Is there significance in him having a private moment with this deaf man who also had a speech impediment, and then the action of putting the fingers into the ears and spitting on the tongue and then looking up to heaven? I'm honestly not sure myself. Grant?
I think it's two things that may mean nothing, but they get my attention.
Yeah.
One is this man demonstrating some level of humility like the woman before. What are the odds of you letting somebody touch your tongue with their spit unless you are willing to humble yourself to that point? And the other thing is Jesus using that particular word so that every time we try to read it out loud, we'll have a little more compassion on somebody with a speech impediment.
Sure.
You know, they mean nothing, but when I read that word, it's like, oh, man.
Yeah, I like that, and I certainly butchered it myself, but... I should have just said be open from the beginning and not even attempted it. But yeah, so interesting thoughts there. Al?
The only part that I see the jump on is the business about looking up to heaven.
Yeah.
Giving the due to God.
Yeah.
Where it belongs.
Yeah.
And that's recorded for us.
Yeah.
So that we can see it. It's not Jesus doing it himself, he's doing it with the power of God.
Yeah, and that goes back to the feeding of the 5,000 as well, right? Where when he's blessing the loaves and fishes, he looks up towards heaven and addresses his heavenly Father. So, yes, Brady, go ahead.
I was going to say one thing that I have learned, among other things, about with having kids is that I tell Eli, Kate, and Rachel, stuff that I want them to remember and know all day long, and I tell them, this is important, you need to remember this, and they don't remember it, they can't regurgitate it, they don't know.
Sure.
I'm hoping that if I tell them enough, they'll get it. However, if we go, like on Mother's Day, and we go and get Danny a present, and I say, don't tell your mom what we got her, the first thing out of their mouth is, hey, we got you a present!
Sure.
And they just spill the beans right there, and it's almost consistently like that. So I think that there is some value here in Jesus doing two things in this passage. One is, which you haven't even gotten into yet, but verse 36. And then the other one is that he, just like what happens in the home, when I take Danny aside to tell her a little something, the kids are like, what did you say? What was that story? What happened? Who else can we tell about that? And the interest is there. It piques the interest. Makes them want to spread the word, even good. Though they don't want the word spread sometimes.
Good point. So you're saying that Jesus' intention behind charging them to tell no one was that he indeed wanted them to tell people. It's the reverse psychology thing. Yeah, okay.
Maybe. It works in my house.
Yeah, certainly. Absolutely. Okay. I don't think you talked about verse 37 either. But yeah, go ahead.
Okay. There's no teaching thing here. Jesus didn't do any teaching here. Like Al said, the only thing he did looked up to heaven and said, "Be open." And the message that they went out and says, "Look what this guy has done. All things he made both the deaf and the hearing, the dumb to speak." No message. All he's done is heal the man. Doesn't say anything about his ethnicity or anything like that. How many people? He doesn't come by himself. Some others bring him. And tell him and ask him to put his hand upon him so that then they've heard about his healing. And so he does heal with no teaching.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good observation. Go ahead, Al.
Even on Jack's mind, I think there is a teaching.
Okay.
Back to Matthew, the last sentence, it says, "And lame walking to help the perfect soul," says, "and they glorified the God of Israel." So it's again drawing attention to where the power is.
Okay, yeah, certainly. Making these people aware of the power, the true power, the nature of the God that was Jesus' Father, that was the God of Israel. Absolutely, certainly, yeah. Okay, Jeff?
Just one other thing that might be going on here, and this is, again, kind of from my assumption that Mark organizes all these little incidents in a intentional order instead of them being just disconnected events. But he sighs and looks up to heaven and says, be opened, just before he's going to feed the multitude for a second time. And the disciples, as you look in chapter 8, still don't get the miracle that he can feed the multitude, because when they're running out of food, they're going to think, or when he's talking about the leaven of the Pharisees, they're going to think he's talking about buying bread.
Yeah.
And he might be doing this, and he might be sighing, because he might have his disciples with him when he goes aside privately from the crowd. And this might be something where he's telling them, you need to open your ears. They may not even know what they need to open their ears about yet, but he may be trying to impress upon them that you don't hear any better than this guy does.
That's certainly something I hadn't considered, but yeah, definitely. Because they don't. They seem to, it just goes one in one ear and out the other, as I think the expression goes, with the disciples. Where, again, he's getting ready to feed another crowd of people, not quite as many, in a different group this time, but the disciples seem to have forgotten pretty quickly the lesson from before. We have just a couple of minutes left, so I'm going to tell you kind of where I came off, at least with Jesus' actions here, with the fingers in the ears and the spitting on the tongue, and kind of my thought behind that. So in Matthew chapter 26 and verse 53, we have the occasion of Jesus being arrested, and then Peter slicing off the ear of the servant, or whoever it was, picking up the sword, slicing off the ear, and Jesus heals the man's ear. And so he says in Matthew 26, do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? And so this is the verse that I could find that demonstrated possibly the full might, or the full power that Jesus had, that where he explains, I could merely say this word, and this incredible, miraculous thing will happen. I'll have an army of 12 legions at my disposal immediately. And so I think to myself, you know, what's he doing, taking the time to put his fingers into this man's ears and then spitting on his tongue? And I kind of think to myself that maybe it's a sensory thing, that's a communication thing with the man himself, him being a deaf man and just appealing to the other senses, possibly, that this man did have at his disposal, and making, again, going back to the personal connection thing, communicating with this man in a way that he would have been able to receive that communication, with the physical touching of the ears, when we know that Jesus could have just merely spoken a word, and, you know, out loud, which he does. He says, be opened. But he takes the extra step here, and he has a physical interaction with this gentleman privately. And so that leads me to believe that he's communicating with this gentleman on a level that he's able to communicate with him on, much like you would an autistic child. You know, my mom deals with autism on a regular basis, and you have to treat each of those children differently. One may be reading on like a third grade level, and the other one's reading like on a kindergarten level and can't even say the ABCs. And so there's a unique way that you deal with each and every one of these. And so I guess that's what we'll end with tonight, since we're out of time, but make sure we understand, especially in individual interactions, that regardless of what our ability is, we need to come down to their level, or possibly try and rise up to meet them at if they're a level above us. But we still try and need to reach all these people. Thanks so much for the comments and discussion this evening. I thought it was definitely worthwhile. So thank you very much.